This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode number 59.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe. This podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without the farm. And that can mean canning, preserving, pickling, and all sorts of artisan food skills, as well as small space food growing, raising chickens, raising bees, or just taking steps towards living a more sustainable lifestyle. If you would like to learn more about any of these topics or my online canning and preserving courses, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. Today's topic is all about backyard beekeeping or just beekeeping in general. And I think you're really going to enjoy it and learn a lot, even if you have no intention of raising bees ever. Bees are just so incredibly fascinating that I think you'll find it really, really interesting. The guest that I have on today is Carla DeLong. I've had her on the podcast before. She was in episode 50, where we talked about how to make vinegar from scratch using a mother. And it was a very popular episode. And Carla and I had talked at that point about also having her come back to talk about beekeeping, because she is a very masterful beekeeper who teaches a lot of beekeeping classes. So I thought it would be really fun to have her come back and talk about that. Now, Carla is from Mountain Feed and Farm Supply Company. It is a homesteader's haven that is here in California, and it is a store with a nursery and all kinds of homesteading supplies, and it is just north of Santa Cruz. Now, if you're not familiar with California, Santa Cruz is sort of between Monterey and San Francisco, so it's right in that area. They also offer classes, and Carla is one of the instructors at Mountain Feed. She is a certified natural chef and a beekeeper and an expert in preserving. So she teaches all sorts of classes there. They also sell the supplies for those classes, so fermentation supplies, cheese making supplies, homebrew, things like that. So I had Carla come back for this episode so that she could talk about beekeeping. And really what we're focusing on here is to be or not to be. Is beekeeping right for you? What exactly does it take? And where do you need to be in your time and in your education in order to actually bring home bees and keep them in your backyard? But what I love also about this episode is that Carla is just so passionate about beekeeping. She throws out there a lot of really interesting information about how they work. And that's why I say, even if you have no intention of ever raising bees yourself, I think you're really going to enjoy learning how beekeeping works and the importance of bees in our everyday lives. We would not have the food that we have if we did not have bees. And you know, if you listen to this podcast, that I talk about things that you can do in your backyards to help and support bees. Well, understanding what it takes to be a beekeeper will also help you support the bees. Now, as you listen to this episode, Carla covers a lot of information, and I just wanted to remind you that everything that she mentions is in the show notes of this episode. And to get that, you can go to livinghomegrown.com/59. I will have links to her free beekeeping video, and I will have links to all the other beekeeping information that she mentions, as well as a full transcript of this episode if you just want to download that and skim through it so that you have all of the information in written form at your fingertips. So without further ado, here is my interview with Carla DeLong of Mountain Feed and Farm Supply. Hey, Carla, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm really excited about this one because I know there's a lot of people out there that are either interested in beekeeping, or maybe they just are curious about beekeeping, or maybe they really know that they want to do this, but they're not sure if they're ready yet. And that's what we're going to cover today. We're going to have you go through how to know if you should be doing beekeeping and if it's right for you. And I know you give a class called To Be or Not to Be, and that's what we're going to cover in today's episode. So thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah, I'm very excited.
Perfect. Well, I think first you should tell everyone about what you do, your homestead, and what you do for Mountain Feed.
Great. So I, like a true homesteader, have a very vast general knowledge of lots of things on the farm. So like last time we talked about making vinegar, today we're going to talk about beekeeping. So a little bit of everything. And that's how we are at Mountain Feed. We're a whole supply store for farms and small scale food production and just wonderful things to help people grow their own food and get back to the land. So for bees, that's a huge one. Especially for preservationists, because honey is really your best bet for a local sweetener here on the West Coast.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So for me, I've been beekeeping not very long, actually. Only this is my 7th year, but I jumped in full hog, I guess. Full bee.
Full bee. Yeah.
And I was trained traditionally. So I followed around a master beekeeper for more than 6 months, really with him everywhere he went, and I was trained hands-on. And I've actually been the president of our beekeeping guild here in Santa Cruz for the last 3 years. So I really, trial by fire, went for it big, and I keep about 40 hives now.
Holy cow, that's a lot.
I'm kind of running my own breeding program where I'm trying to breed better bees that can, you know, be more sustainable, take care of themselves, not need me as much or need as much help as most of the first beginning bees usually do. So that's kind of my long-term goal for Mountain Feed, is to have only local bees that are raised here for us in our environments that don't need as much input.
That makes a lot of sense. So you're saying that by the fact that you are letting them breed in that particular area, that they're in better shape to be able to withstand our particular temperatures or our weather, because this is their territory.
Yes, exactly. And so most of the bees coming from the commercial industry, when you get them and bring them home, they need a ton of help. So, you know, what we're going for is bees that don't need a ton of help, that can actually feed themselves year round and don't need any treatments for mites or other issues. And so that's really our goal, is to have these bees that are strong enough, but also still docile and make honey and pollination. And so that we have more of a well-rounded bee.
So it's kind of like the way we like to do local food. And it's the same as our local bees.
Yes, exactly.
Perfect. Now, so you've been doing this for a while, and you, I know you always dive in full-heartedly into everything, but you also have been homesteading for a while. Just tell everybody just a little bit about your homestead before we dive into the bee stuff, because you really are a true homesteader. And I want everyone who maybe didn't hear the other episode, which was episode 50 on vinegar, where we talked a little bit about what you do, just give them a little overview of what you do at your homestead.
Yeah, so I have a few animals. I definitely have dogs and cats and things like that, but I have chickens and I have pigs. I also have a very large garden. It's about almost 3,000 square feet, and then a small orchard for orchard standpoint, but it's about 60 trees.
Yeah, that doesn't sound small to me at all.
I know. Well, if I'm not a farm, so people ask me all the time, like, oh, where do you sell your stuff? You know, you're a farmer, you're a farmer. And I have to, you know, I'm not actually a farmer. We lovingly call it a mini ranch because we have, you know, livestock and gardening and things. But mostly I grow food just for my family and for my friends, which my family is small. I have a husband and a daughter, but my mother and my sister and kind of our greater family live within 30 miles of me. So I am the farm for the family, and I grow a lot of things that I just dole out, you know, along with the eggs and everything too.
That's awesome.
Well, and the honey, of course.
There's yes.
And there's wax. Although what's funny about, you know, I said I have 40 hives, people always ask me, oh, you must be swimming honey. You have so much honey. And because I am really trying to raise bees as opposed to make a lot of honey, I let them keep 95% of all the honey that they make, because then I'm always assured that they have enough food. Because where I live here in the Santa Cruz Mountains, we do have a cooler and kind of sometimes, not last year, but a rougher winter. And I really want to make sure that their needs come first. So like last year with 40 hives, I took a gallon of honey and that was it.
Yeah, because they do need that to survive. Absolutely. Yeah. So when you're talking about your breeding program that you're working on, so you're planning on, or maybe you already are, selling your bees?
Yeah, ideally. And I do actually, because I'm the president of the Bee Guild, I do sort of dole out bees. I'm not really selling bees at this point, but I certainly give away a lot of bees for people who really need them, and wild swarms or feral swarms and things. So I'm kind of in the bee management phase more than the bee selling phase.
Sure.
But I do breed some queens, and I do raise nukes, which are a small beehive, which is just 4 or 5 frames of brood and pollen and honey with a mated queen all ready to go. And we'll talk a little bit about how do you get bees and, you know, sure, what do you do with them? Yeah. But with the nuke, and actually I'll just introduce that now. So if you wanted to get bees, there's kind of two ways you can do it by buying bees. One is called a package, and it's a little box that's all screened, and it's full of 10 to 12,000 worker bees, which are all female, a few drones, which are male, and then a very young mated queen. And so those, you just get them. They're kind of like a false swarm. So that's one way to go. Those usually come from the commercial industry. And so then you have a nuke, which a nuke is this baby beehive that I'm talking about. And what's great about the nukes is you have all of the life cycles already happening and already going. So you get all of the brood, which brood is everything from freshly laid eggs to larvae, and then the pupas that are sealed into the cells, and then all of the ages of workers. So you have from nurse bees to foragers, and you have this whole life cycle. So for a beginning beekeeper, it's a better way to start because it's more natural for them. And so I do raise nukes. I have yet to sell very many of them because I tend to hoard them all because I am actively breeding and I want to really see how the queens are doing into and past their second year before I will really trust their genetics and see how they really overwinter and if they're mite resistant, things like that. So it is hard to sell bees. They really are like little babies because I spend a whole year growing them, you know?
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. And that's the best explanation I've ever heard of nukes, because I didn't realize that it has the whole life cycle in there.
Yeah. I don't think I said this. So nuke is just an acronym, or it's short for nucleus, mm-hmm, which it literally is the nucleus, the center or the brain of the hive. And so you have this, you know, right down the middle, all of the babies and the queen ready to go. They don't have a lot of stores, so they have to be put into a full-size hive rather quickly, usually within a week, and then they build up very fast.
Yeah, so it's a good place to start if you are just starting out. And we'll go into that. We'll go into that as we go. Yeah. All right. So before we get really into, because we're already getting excited and going down this trail, I'm so excited to talk about this because I just find bees so absolutely fascinating. And I am not a beekeeper, but I always wished I could be. But I know that right now in my lifetime, the way my life is right now, I don't have the time to donate to being a beekeeper. So I'm not. Plus,
right.
I am
very wise of you.
Yes. And it's from talking to people like you that I've realized that. But what I first want to talk about is to have you tell us, or tell the audience, because I think we're on the same page here, why it's so important, why beekeepers, why backyard beekeepers, mm-hmm, or small hobby beekeepers are so vitally important.
Yes. So I'm sure anyone listening to this has also heard that the bees are in trouble, that honeybees in our country have been under a lot of duress, especially since 2006, when it was discovered that there's colony collapse disorder. And we found a lot of links and why that's happening. And really, if you look at it, it's civilization, it's stress for them. So by becoming a hobby beekeeper, you really get to remove the bees and support them in a way that brings them out of the commercial situation. And think about how nice it is for a beehive to live in your backyard, you know, where you there's flowers and you water them and you take care of them. And it's kind of a nice respite for them. You know, it's almost like bee camp. You think of all the bees in the commercial industry, and they've been working very, very, very hard and under a lot of stress to make all of the food that we love and want to eat. And so by becoming a home beekeeper, you really are creating a situation that is kind of this happy medium between bees that are feral that live just on their own in the wild and bees that are pressed into service in the commercial industry. So you can manage them in a way that keeps them very cozy, which is something they don't have in the wild, and they aren't having to work so hard for someone else. You know, in the commercial industry, that's the big thing is they, and don't get me wrong, honeybees love to work. That's their job. They literally work themselves to death. They don't ever stop working. They don't ever take a day off.
Yeah.
But when you're taking care of them, their work becomes very easy, put it that way.
Yes. So managing, the fact that we are managing or that a beekeeper is managing them means that they're getting a little ultra extra pampering and care. So they might have a better immune system. They'll be healthier, happier bees. And that overall is helping the environment. So we actually are making an impact.
Absolutely. And within that making an impact, what's great about bees is, so the queens will mate with up to 20 drones. And so what that means is you have a really good chance of genetic diversity every time you breed a new queen or the new queens go out for their mating flights and get bred. And so by being a hobbyist beekeeper and having these strong, robust bees, you're spreading the genetics by them being able to make it through the winter a little stronger. Then those drones are the ones that will be the first ones ready in the spring to mate. And so the strong genetics are the ones that will proliferate. And even in my, you know, really short time as a beekeeper, I've really seen that our genetics are getting stronger. And it's really wonderful to see. I mean, there is really a big difference. And when we first started, and especially with packages, first year package success rate was only about 50%, which is really, really low. And mm-hmm. And this is why we're doing this class. And this is why I teach this class often. It's a free class. It's totally open to everyone in the world. And I talk to people all about it all the time. It's also why we filmed this class and it's on the internet so people can get a better idea about what it takes. And I joke lovingly that this specific talk is really about talking people out of becoming a beekeeper. Because
yes.
if I tell you all the things that you need to know, if you still think you can do it and do it well, then I know you will do it well. I know you'll be invested. I know that you're ready to be a beekeeper because it's really, really not something you can do while holding your book and holding your smoker and trying to be doing it out there and learning. You know, you really need to be prepared. And those strong home bees now, even within the last 7 years, our success rate has gotten much higher. We're much closer to a 75 or 80% success rate. And I really think that's education and the bettering of genetics by people who have been really careful with what they're doing.
That's awesome. That's totally awesome. And that's why I love what you guys are doing. And in case anyone's listening and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I've got to find that video, I will have a link in the show notes to your actual free class. So it's on your website at Mountain Feed. We'll link to Mountain Feed. We'll link to the class and also where you guys have more information about beekeeping. And the show notes will be at livinghomegrown.com/59. And anybody that is interested in anything that we talk about, I will just point everyone in the right direction so they can go watch that video. It's very, very good.
Yeah, you can also call me at Mountain Feed.
Yeah. Yeah, not her your personal cell phone number though. We'll just
No. But at Mountain Feed, we strive to be a resource center. And really our goal is to give everybody the right tools to succeed. Because and this is beekeeping, this is gardening, this is anything where the way you build confidence is with success. And the way you have success is you're ready and prepared and know what to expect.
Exactly. Yes.
Remember, bees are really strong and they've been on this planet longer than humans have. So they've been doing quite well and they were successful for a really long time. So if we enable them to just do what they need to do and are meant to do, they do quite well. And I think that's why it is one of the best hobbies people can choose that are an outdoor hobby, because it really incorporates all of your senses and also gets you outside, gets you moving. And it's also, you know, a little dangerous. It is a box full of thousands of stinging insects.
There's so a thrill. There's a thrill involved.
So there's a thrill. Yes. So this is something that people forget. You know, it is actually a thrill and it's very exciting. You know, it's not, whereas gardening is marvelous and really fun, but it's not exactly thrilling.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you got a good point there.
It's a little different. And so you get this, you know, all these wonderful combinations of emotions and feelings and, you know, senses from beekeeping that you wouldn't get anywhere else. And it encourages you to keep doing it. And I think that's part of why people, once they really get into it, stick with it. And most people who, you know, you have beekeepers that have been beekeepers for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, because once you're in it and you've succeeded once, and I really consider beginning beekeeping your first 3 years, then we really get into the mad scientist of beekeeping and you can do all sorts of crazy things. But most things, if it's just a beginning thing, you can kind of do it, get away with it. And then you're like, oh, I know how to do that. And maybe just put it away for a while. Well, with beekeeping, you don't want to put it away. You don't want to stop doing it. You want to learn more. You want to get another beehive. You want to keep going. You want to learn how to make splits. So that's why I think it is both hobby and vocation really the most inspiring one of those you could choose.
I think every beekeeper I've ever spoken to has said how the more they got into it, the more they wanted to learn and how much more fascinating they realized bees were. And
oh,
so
yeah.
If you're at all interested, when you start diving into it, everyone always seems to dive in with both feet and really go for it. And I love what you said in that video class. You said bees are untamed domestic species. People don't really think of it that way, but they, you know, it's not like a cat or a dog.
Yeah. Or a cow.
Yeah. Or a cow. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's very clever. You know, those bees, they're very clever. They have wings, which means they have free will.
Yes.
Because they can leave.
Mm-hmm.
A pen won't keep them in. You know, they can actually decide to do what they want when they want to do it. And they do. They definitely, you know, they have free will. They can do what they want. You know, that untamed thing is a difference that you don't get with any other domestic species, because, you know, the definition of domestic is we have trained them basically for our needs. And with bees, they are just still doing all the things they've always been doing. We haven't really changed that much what they do, which is work really, 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 really hard, hoard as much honey as they possibly can, and bring in pollen for the babies and make wax. Those are the things they've been doing for a million years. We just happen to realize that we like all that stuff and we can help them do it.
Perfect. Yes. Now, you talk about basic care, and one of the things you talked about is that you have to think of them kind of as tiny livestock. And that kind of is what you're just saying is, you know, they're like little tiny livestock, but they, you know, we are not the boss of them.
No, but the basics of care, you know, and this is true for humans as well as all the livestock, you know, there's water, food, shelter, and basic care. And basic care meaning if they're sick, do something about it. You know, if you have an animal or you have livestock, you are their caretaker, you are their shepherd. It is your responsibility to create a situation where their life can be as great as possible. And that's what I mean about basics of care. So let's just really quickly go down those four basics of care.
Sure.
So shelter is a beehive, and the hive is the house that they live in. So most typically 99% of beekeeping in this country is Langstroth boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they really work and why most people use them is they are designed off of a very, very small measurement that is called a bee space. And it's a little space that's between, an eighth of an inch and a three quarters of an inch. And what that is it's a walkway for the bees. It's the passageway that they like to have between their combs. And so the way that the Langstroth works is the frames are all that space apart from each other. And it creates a situation where the bees draw perfectly parallel combs all, well, usually. we should very quickly talk about this. There is no always or never in beekeeping.
Okay, good to know. Good to know.
So if anyone ever says to you, oh, my bees will never do that, just wait. And I will try very hard to not say to you, they always do this.
Right.
They always act this way because there's so many things involved in what they do and why they may do something other than, you know, this day than is different than tomorrow. So no always or never. So the Langstroth boxes are modular, meaning that you can go from one box up to six boxes, back down to one box if you need, because they all fit together. They're kind of like Legos like that. You know, you can build them up or put them down.
And these are like those standard ones we always see. They're square.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the orchards, you see them. They're white. The reason they're white is they deflect heat that way. At home, actually, my favorite boxes are pastry box pink. And because I just love them, because they literally out there in the orchard looks like they just look like pastry boxes, but they can be any pastel shade.
Okay.
So those are them. You would paint them on the outside only, not the inside. So Langstroth. And then the other style of beekeeping that we're seeing kind of have a resurgence is top bar beekeeping. And I choose Langstroth over top bar because I really have seen that in the Langstroth, they do a little better because of heat convection. Mm-hmm. Because the way that the Langstroth is built, it's on a vertical plane and heat rises, right?
Mm-hmm.
Heat rises and cold sinks. So with the top bar, it is on a horizontal plane, which means it's kind of long and skinny. And I've seen in the winter that they have a harder time staying warm. So they need a lot more winter management to keep them really cozy. And for that one reason, being where I am up in the mountains, the Langstroth has worked better just for this heat preservation situation.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if anyone has any, and I mean any, like any period, issues with lifting, top bar beekeeping, top bar boxes are the best choice. Because all you ever pick up is one comb of honey or of bees. So at the most, you will only ever lift 8 to 12 pounds. Whereas with the Langstroth boxes, those babies full of honey at a minimum are going to weigh 50 pounds.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah.
So for me, the trade-off of doing more winter management for the top bar would be worth the lifting concern.
Mm-hmm.
And then with shelter, very quickly, let's talk about placement.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is always a really funny one because people think, oh, I live in town. You know, I could never keep bees. My backyard is only 10 by 10. And really, for those people, I have wonderful news, which is bees actually do much, much better in urban areas than they do in rural areas. And the reason is because people plant gardens.
Yes.
There are flowers year round in cities and in towns, and people water them, which is amazing. You know, even this, you know, these last few years with droughts, bees in, you know, in town are still doing better. So in like where I live, I either have flowers, tons of them, or I have nothing. And so the management that goes with that is very complicated. Whereas in town, there's always something.
If you don't have a lot, your neighbor might.
Well, and their average flight for foraging is 30 miles. So in terms of planting for bees, you're much better off giving all of your friends a packet of wildflowers or encouraging them to plant things like bee balm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have plants that where there's bee in the name, mm-hmm. that's the one you plant for bees.
Okay, perfect.
Which is very easy. They also like all of the herbaceous plants. So lavender, rosemary, all the sages they really like. But encouraging all of your friends to plant for bees has a wider impact than you yourself redoing your entire garden, because they do fly so far. They do wonderful on balconies because they can be kind of protected up on a balcony and their flight path is out of walkways. So they don't really interfere with any of the humans down on the ground from that point. So that's something to consider. And really wherever I would put a beehive is in the sun. They prefer to have morning sun if you can provide it. And definitely, you know, the earlier the better. So you want them either eastward facing or southeastward facing where their entrance is. And that way it's kind of like the early bee gets the nectar and the early bird gets the worm. Mm-hmm. Same thing, same sort of thing. The sooner they're warm on their porch, the more likely they are to get up and go for it. And then they also need winter sun.
What about going on the roof?
So the roof is a very good option, as long as it's a good option for the people who are going to be going on the roof.
Ah, yeah, good point. Does that make any sense? Yeah, so, you don't want to be falling off the roof or not being able to get up there.
Especially for beginning beekeepers, even the most confident person should take utmost care of themselves before anyone else, because you're literally going to be opening a box full of 20 to 50,000 stinging insects for the first time. You know, and if you're on a roof, if it's, I really only recommend beekeeping on roofs that are perfectly flat. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can't find a place at your own house, I would rather encourage someone to find a place at another person's house where they could keep bees and maybe do it, you know, in conjunction with another friend. Mm-hmm. Because the roofs that are tilted are very dangerous. You know, if you have to go on a ladder and you're carrying all this equipment, if you're already wearing a bee veil, you can't quite see what you're doing. So roofs are great if they're flat.
That's okay.
And if you have easy access as well.
Yes, that would be very important.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that's shelter and placement. So let's talk about water.
Yeah.
So bees drink water. We all drink water. All the creatures in the world drink water, and they love shallow water that they can't really fall into. So a little bird bath or a bird, you know, or a little fountain that isn't too splashy. They actually like still water. And what's funny is they actually like water that's a little murky. I think it's easier for them to find by scent if it's a little murky.
Okay.
And I'm sure everyone knows they like pool water. So everyone's been around pools and it's like, why are the bees here? Well,
yeah,
they're looking for water, but they are attracted to the scent of the chlorine as well, because it's the same thing. It can kind of help them find the water.
Right. And it might not be a good thing, but they don't know that.
They don't know that. I've personally haven't done any research on chlorine and bees and the impact. I'm sure it's been done, but if you already have a pool, something to do is to set up a little bird bath for them or something, even a bucket of water with a piece of plywood or some cork floating in it that works like a raft mm-hmm. that they can land on and kind of hang out on, to put that closer to the hive than the pool. And usually they'll find that water source before they find the pool, and that will stop so many of them from going to the pool.
That's a really good point too about having something in the water. We've talked about it before on this podcast about having something in the water so that they don't drown. And a cork is a great thing because if they do fall in, they can crawl out by crawling on the cork.
And I would very carefully, this is hard, but I would cut them in half so that they just float and stay stationary. Because if they're round, it's kind of like, you know, like
a barrel run log
dam.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. If they're round, they can spin when the bees try to get on them. So if you cut them in half, they stay flat.
Good idea.
So definitely a water source. And then food. So this is kind of an awkward conversation for me because I am a natural chef as well as all these other things I do. I teach therapeutic nutrition. So when we talk about feeding bees, usually, not always or never, we're talking about feeding them pure cane white sugar, which for humans is not a preferred food. And it's kind of weird that we can say that it's good to feed to bees. And I ask a little patience with this one and a little forgiveness, because I don't recommend that people eat sugar. And yet I teach these bee classes and I tell them, no, really, your first year, you will go through 50 pounds of white sugar. You will. And I actually recommend that people do. And the reason why is the bees who come from the commercial industries, especially, they really, really, really need our help. They have really no immune system. You know, they have to have a lot of output. And so they work really, really hard. Their strength really matters. And when they come from the commercial industry, if you just stick them in your backyard, think of it that they don't have any training to actually take care of themselves.
They're neophytes out there in the world. And I liked your analogy that you gave in your class about if you had a barn full of mice and you decided to get kittens to take care of them and you just put them out there, they wouldn't survive right away.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. It's yes. If you adopt a 3-week old kitten and you throw it in the barn and you say, here, catch mice. Mm-hmm. maybe that cat maybe would make it the toughest, toughest, toughest one. Although then that cat's not going to be very nice.
No.
You'll have a very rowdy cat.
Yes.
If you take the time to hand raise that cat and feed that cat and make sure it's been wormed and all of these wonderful things, then you have this strong, robust, wonderful, loving cat that then will do much, much more work in the long run. And so that is what I mean about first-year colonies needing a ton of help. And I actually do teach organic, treatment-free, everything-free, let them be tough on their own beekeeping on the second and third years of people's beekeeping careers.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair, because if you don't do an intervention on some of the situations that could come up, you'll end up just losing your bees.
Exactly. And that is why this is where I've come to over the years, where I really, really would rather people not have to feed their bees or not have to treat for mites. But that's not the bees we can get our hands on right now. And so as beginning beekeepers, I do recommend that they get packages or nukes. Well, most of the packages come from the commercial industry, which means they really need a lot of help. And most of the nukes actually have already been also pressed into service. They do have a jump because of their healthy, more healthy life cycle, but they too are still like the 5-week old kitten as opposed to a 3-week old kitten, put it that way. Mm-hmm. So with the feeding, the thing about the feeding is if you look at honey on a molecular level, 99% is sugar. It really is. It is sugar. It's that 1% that turns it into this magical, wonderful, precious thing. And so the compromise that we make is we feed them the 99% sugar. Well, what I've seen over time is what this does is you give them this sugar buffet, and what you have to do is make like a simple syrup out of the sugar. So it's like a very light honey, kind of loose sugar syrup honey. That's what you feed them. Well, you feed it to them directly in their hive. I said before their average foraging flight is 0.5 mile. Well, think about how much energy they have to burn for in each bee to go 0.5 mile and back, 0.5 mile and back.
Sure.
Back. Yeah. For one little tiny honey stomach full of nectar. Well, if you give them gallons of syrup right inside of their hive, one of the first things you're doing is sparing them burning all of that energy. And they can really build so fast. They can build wax really fast. They can make babies really fast because they don't have to burn all of those calories just to get calories. Very interesting way to think about it. And then the other side of this, which is why I really push for feeding the first year, is if all they have to do is travel 10 inches to get honey syrup, which is the carbohydrate that they need to make wax, now you have all these surplus foragers who can all dedicate their time to going and getting natural pollen. Well, pollen's what they feed babies. It's what they feed the little baby larva bees. So if they don't have a very good pollen source or pollen diversity, the baby bees will never be very healthy. So here you have a situation by feeding them something that isn't truly an optimal choice, right? We have sugar, which is not optimal, but it is our best option you do give them a situation where now they can get the very most optional choice for pollen. It's a really good trade-off.
Yeah, it frees up their time.
So that's why we need them to eat their own pollen. And there's a huge link with colony collapse with poor sources of pollen and with monocrop agriculture pollen. Mm. So we really want them to have the diversity of diet. And you think about what we tell children, and we aim for human health, which is eat the rainbow, mm-hmm. right? We mm-hmm. want this diversity of color and diet and nutrition. Well, that's true for the bees too. And if you ever have a beehive or can get near a beehive, if you watch them coming in, they bring the little pellets of pollen in on these little baskets on their legs. And one is yellow, then orange, then red, then even black or dark green. And that for them is diversity of nutrition.
Ah, that is so good. And so the idea of feeding them the sugar is really the first year. And
yes.
they concentrate more on the other jobs that they have to do other than collecting food, and they can build up their immunity and they can build up their hive faster. And
yes.
then the second year they're in their groove.
So yeah, so your first year, you have, you know, a couple goals your first year. The biggest one being get them through the first winter. Because if you don't get them alive through their first winter, you don't get to be a beekeeper anymore. You have to be a bee person with a bunch of bee equipment, you know, for a few more months until you can get your hands on more bees. Because this is a seasonal hobby that you get started with. Because what we do is we use their natural tendencies, which is to split in the spring. And so when we make nukes or even packages or catch swarms, it's generally from the end of February to the end of June, depending on where we are. But in California, that's most of our time. And they're building up so fast that that's when we can take advantage of it. If you want to become a beekeeper in September, either it's not possible because there just aren't any bees to be had, or you buy an entire full beehive. Well, when you do that, one, you're inheriting a lot of problems that, you know, you don't know how to deal with. And for me, as a training beginning beekeepers, what I really encourage is that starting with a nuke or a package, because they're very small, which means that your skills are going to grow at the same rate as the bee colony.
Yes.
So that you have this, oh, you know, 10,000 bees is nothing compared to 80,000 bees. And 80,000 bees is your goal for the end of August. It's easy to open a box full of 10,000 bees. It's not easy to open a box full of 80,000 bees. And so if you've spent 6 months training yourself to build confidence and to recognize things that need to be worked on, you know, you're way more confident. So it gets you there to the end. And so with your other goals of the year, is this getting them through the winter? And within that, you kind of have these sub goals. One is confidence, right? Confidence mm-hmm. and knowing what you're looking for, and then knowing what to do once you recognize what you're looking for.
I can see why starting out small and growing with your bees is so important.
Yes.
That's why they tell you to start small, and your first year is a complete learning experience. It's not really so much that it's overwhelming, it's that you have to live it in the moment on the playing field. You have
Absolutely.
To experience it.
Well, and you can read, you know, I actually counted this as what a nerd I am. I've read 38 beekeeping books cover to back. I just counted this. Somebody asked me and I was like, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and I counted them all, you know, and that's literally just the tip of the iceberg on beekeeping literature. I mean, the learning does not end. And there's wonderful research being published all of the time. I mean, we have the American Beekeeping Journal that every month you learn something new, you know. So I think that's also why it's such a good hobby, is you can stay inspired and really, you know, learn things as you go. but you also have to learn things as you go. You really do. You really have to keep on it. And so it demands that it keeps your attention, which is wonderful as a hobby, that it really, it's not like snowboarding where it's like, yay, there's snow, I snowboard, and then I put all my stuff away for 6 months out
sure.
of the year.
Yeah.
It can't be like that. They are really, really livestock where even though in December you might not see them that much, you still have to go out to the hive and physically look at the hive and see what you see and look at what's on the ground.
Yeah. So if you wanted to get into beekeeping, you finally make the decision like, yeah, I'm diving in. It's okay if it's not the right time to start. If we're not in spring when it's the time to really start your beehive, you can just start learning.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, I wouldn't even consider it before you've read 3 books. Mm-hmm. And I mean, read them, like actually read them and see. The reason I say 3 is because there is a ton of overlap in management technique, but there's nuance in all of those books. And people who write books with beekeeping, especially, they don't really let you write a beekeeping book until you've done it and you know what you're doing. And so what you get to do by reading those books is learn from other people's mistakes. And what's wonderful about that means if you actually learned it, you don't have to make that mistake yourself.
Sure.
There's also wonderful magazines. There's also talks like this. I am a little shy of most internet things because you have to have a rigorous examination to have a book. Anybody can put anything on the internet.
Sure.
So come to my website, or, you know, scientific beekeeping is a wonderful one. That's Randy Oliver. He's a great man. He's a biologist and only puts up really, really good staunch science. So, you know, learning from people who really know what they're doing is a huge consideration.
Well, so before we move off of the basics of care, I know people are probably thinking, so how much does it cost?
Oh, yes. So this is kind of a fun one, because if you are a very handy person, it might cost you nothing. You could absolutely build with understanding of the science of bee space, which is really one little law. There's one little law, which is the space between the combs needs to be 1/4 inch. If you can build things that are, you know, 1/32 of an inch on spot, on measurement, then you'd be amazing at building beehives. And if you build something that's even different and very, very cool, call me. I want one. Let me know. Because the law is this tiny space. The law is not a square box. You know, there's, and if anyone's very interested in this, do some research about all of the beehives that were built and made and designed and invented all within, you know, the 1900s. Well, we use Langstroth because Langstroth basically won the patent war, if you think about it that way, because his box was the most modular, which means it's the easiest to move and work lots of hives at one time. But if you're going to have one beehive, don't ever need to move it. You could build something beautiful and different. I know people who have built little barns and, like, you know, ashram temples, and you can build all sorts of wonderful things. There's, you know, there are lots of options.
That's
you
awesome.
You can build your own and get very creative. And again, let me know. Very cool.
Yeah.
But most people, especially your first year, decide to go with Topbar or Langstroth. And most people on average will spend about $500.
Okay. So, and that includes everything from...
And that's everything. Yeah. So that is the bees, the boxes, your protective gear, which will be gloves and a veil, perhaps a jacket. The jacket with the veil is my recommendation because you can always just put it on over jeans and anything else you're wearing and you're just ready to go. The full suits can get really, really hot. So it's usually better just to wear jeans and a jacket. Gloves. I actually don't wear gloves when I keep bees, and I never really did because that's how I was trained. But I always, this is my always, have them in my pocket because if I need them, I really, really need them.
Sure.
Something, if I drop a frame or something, you know, something happens that I'm not unaware of, like they're being harassed by a skunk or something. If I start getting stung, well, I have to finish what I'm doing. I have to put the beehive back together. So I'll stop what I'm doing, put my gloves on, and then go forward. But most people do start with gloves it helps them build confidence. And eventually, most people do start working without gloves, because the thing is, without gloves, you tend to move much slower. You're more careful. Mm-hmm. And because you are more careful, you're actually less likely to squish them or get stung anyways, which keeps them very calm. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a funny trade-off, you know, where it's like, well, I'm not wearing gloves. Oh, but I'm actually, they're much calmer, because you're calmer because you have to act a little differently, you know.
Yeah, you'll look where you place your hands more carefully. You'll move slower.
Yes, but I absolutely insist that people have gloves with them at all times. That $500 also includes like your gloves, some books, and hopefully a class.
Yeah.
For me, I teach a beginning, it's my what I call the intensive series, and it's a, you know, a series of lectures, and also people come with me to the apiary because I want them to learn how I move, because it's something they can't read out of a book. It's something I can't explain to them just by watching me in a lecture miming things. Is I want them to know how I lift the lid, what I do when I pull a frame, how do I actually put that frame back in. It makes a really big difference, and it builds a ton of confidence. So I really, for anyone who's interested in this, I urge you to find your local beekeeping organization. Almost every city has one now in California, and they're called the Guild. Most of them are called the Beekeeping Guild. That's what mine is called, the Santa Cruz Beekeepers Guild. And it's where you can meet your bee community and other bee-friendly dorks like me. People like me who want nothing more than to hang out with you and talk to you about bees. And most people are very, very willing to invite you over and to show you how they work a beehive. And that would give you a really good idea if you're willing to spend the money, jump in, commit to this sort of situation, because it does take quite a bit of time. Like, you know, I said, you'll be feeding 50 pounds of sugar. Well, you'll be out in the bee yard swapping jars of sugar every other day, every third day, for about 8 weeks.
Ah.
So it might only take 5 minutes, but it's 5 minutes every other day for 8 weeks. And then you'll be doing like a hands-on inspection, no more than every 10 days, but up to every 3 weeks. So I always, you know, I tell people, you know, it will take you half of 2 Sundays a month, okay, at least from, okay, you know, March until September. And then it's a little less, but it does take, you know, you can't forget about them. You have to stay kind of aware of what they're doing.
And that's when you just have like one or two hives. It takes that, yeah, much time.
It's actually two hives, and thank you. That's a great question, or a great statement there. I would recommend that people start with two beehives.
Okay.
So that would increase your cost, but it really would. So it puts you more in the $800 range. The reason why is because normal, and this is all normal, my normal, your normal, everyone's normal. Well, normal is only what you're used to and what happens on a day-to-day basis. So if you only have one beehive, then your normal is only that. You don't know if they're doing poorly or if they're doing really well or if they're right in the middle or if something's wrong, because you have no comparison.
Sure.
And if you have a second beehive, they're never the same. No matter what, that free will thing again.
Yes.
You know, that one might be very strong and very, you know, very different and train, you know, so it trains you way faster. So this is a benefit of having two.
One thing I'm thinking people who are listening might not know the answer is, where do they get the bees? They may say, okay, I think I want to do this. Where do I get bees? Because they may not be living in California. You know, right, I have listeners right all over.
Yeah, so that actually brings us back to your local bee guild, mm-hmm, or beekeeping supply store. So most of the beekeeping supply stores in this country, we have quite a few actually, really good ones, and most of them will sell both nukes and packages. And then most beekeeping groups get together collectively and will buy a large allotment from a commercial beekeeper of packages. And by doing that, they can have better buying power, right? They'll get a better,
sure,
price.
Sure. Yes.
If you are just buying bees as an individual, not with a group or through your bee supply, I would look for bees that I can get as close to me as possible, because those bees, and you have to ask a lot of questions, because even someone who is selling bees next door to you doesn't mean that those bees weren't raised in Hawaii.
Sure.
Or California, right. Or Texas, or Florida. So you have to be aware of, if you're in South Dakota, find someone who is actually raising bees in South Dakota with stock that is what is called a survivor stock or acclimated stock. So that is bees who have lived in that area longer than 2 years without a lot of intervention from the humans. Who maybe, you know, who you want bees that are bred to their location and to their habitat. And those are the ones that will certainly do better without as many inputs from us.
That's excellent. Excellent tips. We're looking for ones that have been bred to our particular location.
Yes. And if you can't, it's not a reason to stop what you're doing. I absolutely started with some packages that had queens not bred from here. And, you know, it's an easy way to get started. A package is an easy way to get started because they're the most affordable. They need the most help. So it forces you to be a functional beekeeper. You have to stay on it. And usually your second year, when you get into second year, those bees will requeen, which means they will make a new queen on their own, which is wonderful, wonderful behavior. And you want them to do that. Or they might swarm, which usually means they will leave you a brand new queen also. Or you can do a situation where either you can put them in a place where they will make you a new queen. We won't go into that. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, it's more advanced.
Yes, more advanced. But any new brand new queen who is born in your habitat will breed in your habitat. And then you will have this locally adapted queen. So we can get to locally adapted stock the second and third years. We definitely get there. Mm-hmm. That's our goal, is that's where we're going. But the first year, if you get a package that has a queen bred somewhere else, don't worry. Just go for it. Just go with it. And package queens, they can either be the most amazing queen you've ever seen in your whole life, lay 2,500 eggs a day, which that means 3 weeks later, there's 2,500 bees, 2,500 bees that are being hatched every single day. It's incredible how many bees can be hatching on emerging from their cells, ready to go.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. So it's not to knock a package queen. They can be amazing. They're usually just not bred to where you are.
So you just might have to keep a closer eye on that type of situation. So you want to know going in.
Yes. And that's really if you're looking at your genetics. So the last thing we have to talk about with basics of care, and this is part of your cost as well, and what you need to buy or pay for, is first year beekeeping. 95% of the time, your bees will need to be treated for a pest that is called a Varroa mite. So a Varroa mite is not native here to North America and has caused horrendous issues with bees and causes total colony bee loss. It is a contributing factor to colony collapse disorder. And certainly anyone getting a package, my advice really is first year, treat them, please, please treat them. Because I see a 95% loss of packages, especially that don't get treated for mites.
Wow.
It's very sad. And I used to be a little more casual with my recommendation, which, you know, if you want to go totally strictly no treatment, cool, try it, see how it goes. But I've seen over the years that people who don't do that end up losing their bees. And it's very depressing. And it's rather a waste. It's a waste of the bees. It's a waste of the money. And so as treatment goes, I only use and recommend two things that are recommended for organic treatment. There's some very, very harsh chemical treatments, and I do not recommend anything that is a radical, in my opinion, harsh chemical treatment. So only something that would be approved for organic beekeeping is something I would recommend. So the reason for that, one is it's better for our environment, it's better for the people, but it's certainly better for the bees, but it's actually better for the mites as well, because what's been going on is the mites have been being killed off with these very, very, very harsh chemical treatments, and what it does is it's kind of like the antibiotics where you wipe out 99% of all the bees, or all of the mites, excuse me, you wipe out 99% of all of the mites. Well, you have this 1% that's totally immune to these chemicals.
Yeah, so then you get a mutant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So for me, using a treatment that doesn't kill off all the mites, that's actually fine, because what we're trying to do is have bee populations that can deal with the mites on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing that in my breeding programs, my survivor stock and what I'm breeding locally, they're getting better and better and better at getting rid of the varroa mites on their own. And eventually we'll get there. I think that we will get there. We'll get to the point where the bees and the mites can live in harmony and it will be fine and everything will be great and they'll work it out, because that's evolution. That's what we need. We need them to work it out.
Sure.
You know, but in the beginning, as a beginning beekeeper, if you have a package, treating them with an organic treatment really, really is the second part of getting them through the winter. The first part being feeding them enough that they make enough wax that they can make enough bees to get through the winter, and then treating those bees so that they survive.
Yeah, so you're building up their immune system. You're kind of giving them a little head start. And then usually you might not even have to do that again this second year, correct?
For me, I've had great success with that, yes.
And that's good.
Especially if they requeen and you get a new queen that's bred to your location the second spring, usually that's interbred with survivor stock that is in your location. So it really makes a huge difference. And again, you know, we're looking at, you know, some cost up front to get us through to a worthy ending, which is still being a beekeeper the next spring.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And one thing about that first year that I wondered a lot about is, if you're trying to get them through winter and you know that they need to have their food for winter, does that mean that you should not take honey the first year?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So it doesn't mean you can't take a spoon with you
out
there in the fall and have a little bite.
Sure.
But you think of also your first year, you're feeding them 50 pounds of sugar. You're feeding that for them to build wax. But most likely any honey that's in that hive the first year is adulterated by sugar.
Oh,
also, and I've had many a new beekeeper, you know, oh, my bees made so much honey. I fed them all the way to September. And so I took some honey. Yeah, all they're doing, that's just sugar.
Yeah.
And it looks like honey. And sure, it tastes good because the bees are mixing it with a bit of natural nectar. But really, that first year, it is ideal to let them keep everything, because the stronger they are, the more robust they are, the better off you are.
Sure.
And the more successful you will be.
Well, Carla, this has been so, so informative, and I so appreciate everything that you've been telling us to try and make people kind of take a look, step back and take a look as, number one, if this is right for them. And also, it's so fascinating that even if they didn't want to do beekeeping, I think they're going to want to learn more. But one thing I remembered you saying in that class, you rattled off a list of what it takes to be a beekeeper. And I'd love for you to give those the list of what those things are.
Oh, sure. And, you know, as you can tell, I love this. You know, I love beekeeping. And I think really that's part of it is, you know, to be impassioned about this hobby and to love it is really part of it, is if you are inspired to do it, that will make you succeed even better. Like me, it's very fun.
Yes.
But really what I believe is, you know, being over prepared. So being ready is what that means. You know, read your books, find a mentor, go to the beekeeping websites, find your local bee guild, be ready, you know, be already introduced to things, a positive attitude, because that is huge. You know, things might go wrong. We're talking about a large box full of stinging insects, right? You're going to get stung. And someone asked me, like, I actually got stung. Yes, at some point, if you're going to be a beekeeper, you will get stung. It's okay. It really is okay. It's part of the deal, right?
Sure.
But to be positive about that, be excited. I got stung for the first time. And even if things go wrong and you don't make your bees get them through the first winter, you know that that is a learning experience in itself, and you'll know what to change and do better for next year. You know, so then I would say attention to detail. because for them, especially if you are with them often, even standing in front of the hive and watching them come and go, you'll get used to what is their normal. And if you're paying attention to those small things, you'll be able to catch very quickly when something isn't right or when something is different. So really being aware of those small changes really does help. Definitely a cool head and a calm manner. So even if you get stung, even if you knock a box over, I mean, I've dropped a whole box, I've knocked over a frame, things happen. And the calmer you are, the easier it is to get out of a bad situation, right?
Sure.
So
yes.
That definitely. An open mind and a willingness to learn, I think, is huge, because the bees themselves, you know, will train you more than the books will, more than I can, if you're open to it. You'll learn from the way they sound, the way they smell, really interesting things. So being willing to be open to those things. And then certainly patience, because it'll be 2 or 3 years before you get any honey.
Sure, yes.
and other things. And then really also, don't forget, it will take that much time. So this is an investment situation. You know, it's, you're looking at returns for the second year, the third year, the 10th year. And, you know, you'll get to make candles at some point and lip gloss and all these wonderful things if you follow through with all the things you have learned.
Awesome. That is so great. Well, and if someone is listening to all of this and thinking, I'm not ready now, I think I still would like to do this, but I'm not ready now, then you've given them so much information to start and where they can start looking and learning. And eventually, if they get to the place where they feel they can make the commitment, then they can dive fully in and have this wonderful experience. So I think this is great.
Yay! And it actually makes me very proud of humans and people in general when they decide they're not quite ready.
Yeah.
Do a lot of learning and because you want to be ready. And then when you are ready, you really, really know it, and you really know you can do it successfully. And that's what we're looking for. That's what you want, is someone who is ready to go, because they will succeed and really get all of the gifts that beekeeping has to offer.
Fantastic. Well, Carla, thank you so much for coming on the show again. I'm really excited about everyone listening to this, and I will have links in the show notes to pointing them all into your direction so that they can watch the video and the class and get all the information. So thank you so much for coming on.
You are so welcome. Have a wonderful day.
So that was my interview with Carla of Mountain Feed and Farm Supply. I hope that that gave you a little insight into what it takes to be a beekeeper. It's not something that you want to dive in lightly, but if you do, it can be so, so rewarding. And remember that every resource that Carla mentioned is included in the show notes for this episode. And you can get that by going to livinghomegrown.com/59. And I'll also have a full transcript of the episode. So that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you learned something, even if you're not going to be a beekeeper. I hope that kind of inspired you to have a big appreciation for what bees can do for us and what the beekeepers are doing for the bees. So until next time, just try to live a little bit more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.